Aloha and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As we like to tell you each week, our conversation includes you, and if you're calling us now, you can be involved with this conversation as we are taping the show at 11 a.m. Bills by the batch have been making their way from their originating to their opposite chamber in the legislature. Today is the deadline for bills to make crossover, and at this halfway point, we're taking a look at what has survived, what hasn't, and what all of this says about a session that seems to be without a clear theme other than less money and what to do about rail. Back to look at the session midway are Neil Milner and Colin Moore. Neil Milner is a former political science professor at the University of Hawaii Manoa, where he taught for 40 years. He's also a columnist for Civil Beat and the contributing editor to HPR's The Conversation. Colin Moore is the director of the UH Public Policy Center. And, of course, you're here, too. We want to know what bills you're following this session that are still alive or that didn't survive. And compared to past years, are you more or less engaged in what's going on at the legislature? You can call us at 941-3689 if you're on Oahu, 941-3689. Or if you're on the Neighbor Islands or listening to the live stream and you're calling us again at the time at which we are live at 11 a.m., you can call us at 877-941-3689. Welcome back to both of you.
Pleasure to be here.
Glad to be here.
We blinked and here we are midway through the session. So I want to ask you first that, you know, as we went into this session, we all agreed that rail was going to be a big issue this time around. Obviously, we had just learned that there was going to be a lot less money to be dealing with. But other than that, there seemed to be no real theme in the way that we've seen in other years. Would you agree with that still?
I'd agree with that. I mean, this the theme for this year might be the great miscellany. I mean, it's a lot of things that have been floating around. I mean, it doesn't mean there's not important bills, but I think Neil and I will talk about how this is pretty characteristic of the Hawaii State Legislature. I mean, it's a sort of center-left but a relatively cautious body that likes to work around the margin. So no big, bold proposals, but there's still a lot of significant bills that crossed over this time.
All right, so no big, bold stuff, incremental stuff, and no real great theme other than, as Colin has said, the great miscellany.
Yeah, theme often means gets translated into crisis, and crisis often gets translated into big trouble for the legislature, something that they have to deal with that they may not really want to deal with. And, I mean, we've seen this over the years when issues come up and totally take over. The same-sex marriage one was certainly one like that. This session, for good or for bad for the legislature, is pretty much within their wheelhouse, where you have to operate incrementally, given the fact that there's budget constraints. And what you'll see as we begin to talk about the issues, that often instead of looking at big solutions, there'll be pieces of smaller solutions that they hope to put together to deal with problems. Again, as Colin says, that's how our legislature likes to work. But there are also downsides to that, as we'll see, which means that you can't always do what you maybe would want to do and what some of the public would want to do because you don't have the capacities.
And if you're dealing with it on a piecemeal basis, it may not all sync in a way that, you know, achieves your aim.
Well, that's right. And you also don't know how the pieces are going to come together, if at all, when we go into the deep, dark moments of the final sessions of the legislature where anything can happen and where we really don't know until afterwards.
Right. And that's, of course, always the difficulty in following Hawaii state politics, is that because we're in a one-party state, I mean, the Senate, of course, famously now has only a single party, it becomes more difficult to really see where the conflicts are, where the tensions are. And I think as we move through our list today, I mean, there's some important stuff that's kind of buried, hasn't gotten a lot of press, but probably is significant. Some stuff that didn't make it through crossover, it's a little hard to tell why, for whatever reason, it didn't make it through.
Well, to start, Colin and Neil, let's look at some of the things that didn't make it through. And that, in some way, also helps us shape the character of this particular session, such as it is, which seems to be in many ways sort of like a regular session. And maybe we shouldn't be looking for great themes or be glad that we're dealing with business, but maybe not as piecemeal as it seems that we're doing. So what didn't pass? Let's start with one that was going to be a great big bold move, Willis Barrow's bill to have a $2 billion bond floated to be able to build affordable housing. something like this was done in Los Angeles, but this bill would have, and for in LA's case, it was strictly for homelessness, but in what would have been, in our case, this would have been for affordable housing in general. What do you make of that bill not passing?
Well, I don't think it's surprising it didn't pass. I mean, we don't tend to support these bold measures anymore. But I do think that Willis Sparrow's $2 billion bond bill was a great idea. I mean, if you actually want to make a dent and do something for affordable housing, you need to do something like this. I mean, building 200 more extra units, another $50 million, isn't really going to do much of anything. So the Sparrow bill here, which was SB 591, proposed a huge number of subsidies financed by this bond for rental units, for for-sale homes, for homeless shelters, and it would target people, you know, at a relatively high level. So, I mean, Hawaii, it's, you know, $98,000 as an individual, $140,000 as a family. And so I think this was, I mean, this probably would have made a difference. But again, in our legislature is cautious. This is a bold move. I think it makes them nervous about, you know, how much the state can actually afford. I mean, how many bonds it can support. So I'm not surprised it went down. And I think it's an example of why you see them favoring these incremental approaches. And in some cases, that works well. I mean, in some cases, you test the waters, you try it out a few times, and you can expand a program. And I think we'll talk about some examples of where that might work. I think the Kapuna legislation this time might be an example of that. But for affordable housing, you've got to do something bold. And that is always the number one issue that people say they care about.
Yeah, let me just add something about affordable housing. Here are two assumptions that I think are safe assumptions to make. On the one hand, you are simply not anywhere anymore going to get full-on government-built public housing. That's not only out here, it's out almost anywhere. The merits of it aside, that's happened. The other side of it is that it's pretty clear that you can't depend on the private market, on developers to solve this problem because there isn't enough profit to be made in it. So if you make that kind of assumption, then it becomes very difficult to see how you can get a lot of capital involved without a kind of bond issue, which is not the same as actually the Fed's building these sorts of housing. But what you get here this time is the little kinds of things that can help some people. Encouraging developers through some financial incentives to build more, giving some aid to renters, the rental aid, which they've started to do, and certainly helps the housing, and
increasing the low-income tax credit.
Increasing the low-income tax credit, and finally giving the making it slightly easier for people to buy houses.
But okay. You guys are already running into the things that we know are passing, but I want to go back to some of the stuff that didn't. Lot of people were really looking at this time around. The Styrofoam bill, for example, that one had a lot of attention from, of course, environmental folks really having pushed this, and it went flat.
And it went flat. I mean, this one in part, I mean, may just be so much part of local culture, right? Getting your plate lunch on Styrofoam. And of course, you know, people, I think, you know, more seriously, small businesses, the legislature is very sensitive to the complaints of small businesses. And people who run lunch counters have long opposed this, the elimination of Styrofoam. And I'm not so surprised that this didn't pass. I mean, the opponents, I mean, there are, of course, the proponents on the environmental lobby, but the opponents are pretty powerful folks, and the legislators tend to listen to them. So it's not so surprising that didn't pass. The one that might, you know, the other one that didn't pass, which I was a little more surprised about, is this, you know, what I've called the mayor can't have two jobs bill, which would, you know, this, of course, is a direct critique of Mayor Caldwell's position as a member of the Board of Territorial Savings, which generated a lot of negative press. I actually think it's a pretty, you know, reasonably sensible bill, but it also didn't go through.
Before you went off on that one, I was going to ask you to stay with environmental issues and talk a little bit about the pesticide buffer bill, because that also didn't pass, which pretty much ends what we have seen, you know, coming through as we've watched it island to island trying to create something of this type.
You know, I think both of these show that as strong as environmentalism is in some areas in this state, the power of environmental groups to overcome certain kind of objections. One objection is that it should be the feds who does this. The objection is comes from the big farmers or from the small side. It's pretty strong. So you're right. This does end what the Maui grassroots referendum had tried to do. I think the legislature just doesn't simply want to touch this. They're worried about federal issues. They're worried about other stuff. And I think this is a good – I can't imagine this coming back and being more likely to pass in the future.
Yeah, and let's be honest. I mean, the seed companies have spent a great deal of money on political campaigns. So that certainly does – that does have an impact.
Not coming back either, the feral – Cats Task Force?
The Feral Cats Task Force. Well, Neil and I always joke that one of the most powerful lobbies in the states are the pro-cats folks, and they demonstrated their power yet again. So no Feral Cats Task Force.
Listen, if you can't get a task force passed, which is that's the default for anything that's controversial, then you really know.
And all right.
Okay.
So, but going on issues that are controversial, obviously one we've been talking about for a long time, the minimum wage, that also went down.
That went down. I think that's going to be back for sure. I think it was a little easier to defeat this time just because there isn't the kind of building political pressure that there was last time. But it's going to come back again and again. And I suspect in a couple of sessions down the road, we'll get up to a $15 minimum wage.
In other states, the minimum wage increases, the big minimum wage increases, have done by going outside of state legislatures, either by referendum or by city council. State of Washington is a good example. Here, you can't do it. It's virtually impossible to do it that way here.
A couple of the others that didn't pass, which are hugely unpopular, so it's not surprising, are increasing the fuel tax and the vehicle tax and registration fee. That was vehemently opposed, but also it's something that has been brought up by some pretty powerful folks in the legislature and the governor who think this is the only way to improve our infrastructure. But this is a really tough thing to sell to voters. I mean, this is a sort of bill that members of the legislature are scared of because it will come back to haunt them during election time. This is the stuff voters remember.
Big time. What else on your list? On mine, we've got the constitutional bill that would have limited judicial selection.
That's right. This was hugely controversial. It came up last time. The legislature is clearly angry with some judges, and no one knows exactly what the issue is, but I think everyone suspects that it was because of, their decision that they had to provide more money to the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. They actually gave a specific number, which I think offended the legislature's sense of the separation of powers. There's also some talk that some of their decisions around the TMT issue motivated this. But in any case, the idea is essentially that the legislature would have more power to get rid of judges they didn't like.
When you worry about legislative transparency, this is the kind of issue you should worry about. This has remained an inside baseball issue that does not get discussed publicly by the legislature. And the lack of an opposition party means that there's nobody who's going to go outside of this.
That's exactly right. And I think, maybe you would agree, Neil. I think one of the main reasons this failed is because a bunch of retired judges, pretty prominent folks, came out in opposition to it and really made it a much more salient issue. Yeah.
But it's been back a few times now.
All right. We've got callers on the line. We want to bring you into this conversation, too. We're going to talk about now what is moving through the legislature, unless either one of you has any more to talk about what didn't.
Joe Suki brought up gambling once again. This was going to be a little offshore
gambling. We talked about this at the very beginning. That wasn't going to
happen. Yeah. That's not going to happen.
Okay. All right. That's fine. We're going to go off and take a few callers now. Rachel calling us from Kona. Aloha, Rachel. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha.
Go ahead.
I'm calling to discuss Senate Bill 1312, the licensure of midwives. This bill crossed over from the Senate to the House with warp speed, and I'm a traditional midwife on the Big Island of Hawaii, and this bill essentially makes the majority of midwives that do home birth in Hawaii illegal and prosecutable through the criminal courts by the Attorney General.
This isn't the first time that we've had a run at a bill like this, and I can remember many years past there have been some. There's still half a session left. What are you going to do with some of your other compatriots who are midwives and would like to see this thing defeated?
Well, the bill offers licensure to a small percentage of the midwives, to certified professional midwives, and they're all on board for this bill to go through because it enables them to continue practicing. But the traditional midwives, the cultural midwives, the spiritual midwives, the religious midwives, the rest of us are left out of this bill and face criminal prosecution if we don't attain basically a degree that would require all of us to relocate to the mainland. They're only going to accept MEEC accredited school graduates, which is a 3-year degree, and there are no schools currently allowed in the state of Hawaii. Also, this bill doesn't follow the Sunrise audit's findings. The 2015 bill that you're referring to was actually ended with a request for a task force to be assembled. That was never done, but a Sunrise audit was performed, and the auditor did find that it was necessary for the midwifery profession to be licensed, but what his recommendation was that the way that it was put through was flawed because it didn't follow the Hawaii Regulatory Licensing Reform Act, and that all midwives, the entire midwifery profession, should be offered licensure, not just one type of midwife.
So now what will you do?
Well, I currently have been working on my own bill for several months, but I don't know that I'm going to be able to get it in as quickly as I had. This thing seems to be going rather fast. We've been calling our senators. We've been calling our House representatives. If you look at the testimony that was submitted, it's overwhelmingly in opposition of this bill. There were 170 opposition testimonies and 8 in favor of. There are no...
And forgive me for interrupting, but we've seen other bills like this in past, too, that not just about midwifery, but where you've had overwhelming support for something and or opposition to it, and it goes the other way. I want to ask both of you, because this happened with the Styrofoam bill, too. I mean, there were, 600 pieces of testimony in favor of it, and it summarily went down too.
Well, look, you don't learn a lot, and legislators know this by counting testimony. I mean, they know that there are, there's certainly opposition lying in wait that don't necessarily come out to testify. And those for the Styrofoam bill would be the small business owners.
But the
midwifery bill, yeah. I mean, this is another example of, I think, a long-term fight between the more traditional medical practitioners in the state and the allied practitioners. You saw a bill this time actually that went through that would allow psychologists to prescribe prescription medication. That's been debated for a long time. And there is always this fight between I think all by well-intentioned people between traditional medical practitioners who want to, I think they think they're protecting the integrity.
They're pointing to safety.
And safety, and people who say that there are many people who can provide safe care, and usually this is the most powerful argument, and we need more. Those traditional practitioners are not in rural areas on neighbor islands, and we can provide those services that we need. But it's a complicated emotional issue that is both about science and about access to health care.
Actually, this issue with midwifery and doctors is about 400 years old. I mean, it goes
back to
when they began to split away. The consumer affairs people, the state bureaucracy, is really an important player in this because they're always reluctant to license because they see licensure as a form of monopoly. And so they're careful on this. I think that one of the interesting things would be to look at what the auditor actually says about this. I don't know the auditor's report, and to see what kind of model that they're developing here. I don't know enough about the details of the bill, but the dynamics of this and the split between people who are trained one way and the other. Just forget about the merits of the argument for a second and understand that the more you have licensure, the fewer people can do the work. And the fewer people that can do the work affects, of course, the market.
All right, we're going to go take some more callers. If you'd like to join us, our phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. That's, of course, available to those of you who are listening to us right now live as we are on at in the 11 to noon hour. Going to Richard Tillotson calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Richard.
Aloha. Aloha, Bethann. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling in support of Senate Bill 559, a bill for an act relating to climate change. And this bill would mirror, insofar as possible, the principles embodied in the Paris Climate Agreement that President Obama signed in Paris and has been agreed to by 193 nations, but which is in jeopardy due to the attitude of the new administration in Washington. But the Paris Climate Change Bill has specific wording which encourages states and regions and cities to follow as far as possible they can the attempt to reduce carbon emissions and to abide by the principles in the agreement. So it's something that's been encouraged, and I want to applaud the Senate for passing out the Bill 559 unanimously, and that has now crossed over to the House.
All right, we're going to talk about that a little bit, but this seems to be very much in the vein of what we saw happen with some of the health care policies that were brought into this session to be able to mitigate in some way what might happen with the ACA, and looking at how federal policy might be in some ways disregarded by having a state law in place that would allow the state to move forward as it believes it should go ideologically.
I think that's right. I mean, this is the beginning stages of blue state federalism. I mean, this was always the favorite tactic of red states under liberal administrations. It's a little more difficult for a tiny state like Hawaii to do things like that. When California acts, people listen. When we act,
they say that's nice.
They say that's, you know, that's interesting. Look at Hawaii. It's doing these funny things out there. And so I think you can see, I mean, and this, but that, I think that's a way to understand this. And it may be, you know, perfectly right for us to exercise that authority. But I think what you're seeing is the legislature trying to figure out how they can be critical of the Trump administration. But unlike California, we're very, very dependent on the federal government. And you saw this in particular with this interesting debate about the tax return bill.
Right. But people are calling the anti-Trump bill.
Yeah, the anti-Trump bill, which is a bill, if folks haven't heard of it, which would require presidential candidates to release their tax returns in order to appear on the ballot or to secure the vote of Hawaii electors.
Right. But, I mean, the question is, how are you going to enforce that when election time comes around and you say, sorry, you're not going to be on our ballot, we're not going to vote for
president? Well, it would become pretty supremely unpopular, I think, in that moment. And I don't know, unless it was a very, very close election, in theory, it would force the candidates to release their tax returns because they'd want those four electoral votes. But yeah, I mean, this is clearly just a shot across the bow of the Trump administration. But the interesting thing about the debate around this bill, because everyone knew that's exactly what it was the reluctance by some Democratic state legislators to support it, simply because they're worried about antagonizing our, you know, fairly petty at times and vindictive president. And it's pretty hard to read this bill as doing anything other than
that. Well,
it
goes back to the idea of trying to pick their battles.
That's right.
Which is a good way, though, to get back to the Paris Accords bill, because one of the things that's happened in California, besides having the resources, is that from day one of the Trump election, the governor has been out in front of this, basically saying to the Trump administration, we're going our own way. He's been the bully pulpit here. So this is as important as it may be to pass this as an initial stage. It is it's essentially saying we aspire to do these kinds of things. And as Colin says, there are costs to going beyond that, but there certainly isn't evidence yet of others in the state making the kind of bold statements that you're—
That's right. Unlike California, where it's Jerry Brown leading the charge. I mean, we have Governor Moonbeam anymore. And I can't really see Governor Ige.
As he was once known, yes.
Yes, he was.
All right. Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you'd like to join the conversation, we're taking a look at the legislative session midway, what passed, what that means as we go forward, potentially. What are you looking at? What have you lost in perhaps something that you've wanted to see pass this time around? Are you following this legislative session any differently than you had compared to other years? Really, how engaged are you? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Natalie calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Natalie. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha, Bethan. Thank you for taking my call.
A pleasure.
So I was wondering if you could cover two things. First of all, in the process of the crossover, with respect to conference committees, how are those final bills determined? And then the second thing I'm really interested in is SB 1183, the rail tax bill, and I'm curious what your speakers today think about what will happen in the House to that particular bill.
Okay, we'll take the first one that you asked about what happens specifically, what's included in a final bill. How does that happen? A lot of cutting and pasting.
I mean, the answer is the same to both of those questions. Yeah. There really is no way of knowing. I mean, it's almost totally open. There are some kind of rules about total substitution, which are often violated anyway. So the answer to Natalie's question is, that you can't possibly know. And specifically on rail, all you have as a bill on rail is this little statement that says the skim that the counties used to, that the state used to take for administering this will now be given to essentially to Oahu to help pay for rail. That's not how it's worded. That's it. But certainly it's possible that anything could happen that would that will have very little to do with that, because it's certainly within the rules and you're not going to know.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's
wish we had a better answer for you.
Yeah, sorry,
wish
Natalie.
We had a crystal ball. Sorry, Natalie, but thanks for asking.
I mean, there have been proposals to limit somewhat the ability to quote gut and replace some of these bills.
Yes,
Frankenstein
right.
bills. Yeah,
and
things
are going to happen on rail for sure. Public things are going to happen on rail because essentially what the message is to the mayor, Mayor Caldwell, is you've got to come back with something
with more skin in the game.
More skin in the game.
All right, our number, if you want to get skin in our game, is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Paco calling us from, I'm not sure where, but on the line with us now. Aloha. Okay, so he was a shy caller. You guys have to tell me that. Shy caller Paco wants to know if there's any appropriation for rat lung disease that would be reaching any sort of bill at all or funding for the bill. As we try to find you an answer for that, do we have another caller that we're moving to? Okay, a lot of people on the line, though, trying to get in. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Well, let's continue on with our list, because we each made a list, and as we always do, looking through to see what is moving, how things are moving. I want to talk to you guys about homelessness, because this time around we had something that was unlike anything we have ever seen, certainly something that got a great deal of attention within Hawaii and especially outside of Hawaii. Of course, we're talking about Senator Josh Green's bills, SB 2 and 7, that would consider homelessness as a health condition and therefore make it able to be funded by Medicaid funds for housing. A very different, a very novel approach, but something that he says is grounded in the medical data that shows that people who are homeless die roughly in their very early 50s.
Not only die, they get there much sicker for a long time.
And cost a great deal more. And going to the ER every year, on average, I think he told us yesterday, about $120,000 per person, and that the savings becomes about a 43% savings when someone has a roof over his or her head, and the offset is direct.
Yeah, this is a really very different approach, and that's why it's getting national attention, because essentially this deals with housing through Medicaid. And even if the Republicans pass a change in health care, it's likely that you'll have even more discretion to use Medicaid. And what Green's bill does is allow you to pay for housing for the homeless for or whatever. And he has some pretty good information that it's much cheaper to do it that way.
Yeah, it's not going to cost $120,000 a year.
That's right, because you're reducing health costs and you're also doing kind of other things. And there is something in the bill to look at the data over time to audit it. So this is really one of the few big solutions that has gotten in there. Other pieces of the homeless thing that are in here and are not necessarily – they're complementary for sure. But that's as I say, it's gotten national attention because it hasn't been done before.
I mean, there's also the mobile clinic bill that passed.
There's some other stuff for Housing First and a few other things that have got – the mobile clinics. And there's also –
But there's also a House bill about the safe zones.
Safe zones.
And that seems to be in some ways thwarting the whole idea of creating the Housing First model and being able to get a roof, a solid permanent roof, over someone's head.
Well, I think that's right. It's the equivalent of there's no atheists in foxholes. When you have an enormous problem in front of you, you just toss out many different things. You know, the policy process can't be that rational. And so some people want to do this. Now, again, what might happen in conference committees and might happen is that some of these things will disappear. But I think right now, the feeling is there are lots of different ways to approach it. We don't all share the same ways, and we'll go ahead and do it. But for sure, all of these other ways, even safe zone, is a fairly conventional way of responding to this.
All right. We have a caller on the line calling us from the North Shore. Mike, looking at the overview of bills on short-term rental. So I guess we're going to be talking about Airbnb. Aloha, Mike. Are you there?
Yep, I'm here. Airbnb to some extent, but mostly the longer-term rental market that's represented mostly by VRBO. There was a flurry of bills crossing back and forth. Unfortunately, the short-term rentals have been identified as the cause of the shortage of long-term rentals. My own view is that the fact long-term rentals have become less available is because the value of the houses is so much, people are not willing to rent at a price that local families can afford anymore. You don't rent a million-dollar house out for $1,500 to $1,600 a month. But in any event, it's become a hot-button issue, but for the wrong reason, because recent studies seem to be showing that there isn't any relation between the short-term vacation rental and the long-term rental market. In any case, what's happening with all the bills that were going back and forth?
All right. You want to pick that one up there?
Sure. So we have an answer for you, at least on what has been termed the Airbnb bill, which did cross over last time and was passed. And this would allow, as was suggested.
Wasn't that today?
Yeah. This crossed over today, and it would allow the state to collect taxes from both legal and illegal renters through Airbnb. The debate is pretty simple here. I mean, it's about, should the state take advantage of this pretty robust platform that already is being used to at least get some money? Or by doing so, do they legitimize Airbnb, which a lot of people oppose for two major reasons. The first is that they don't like all these tourists in their neighborhoods. They don't like houses next to them being turned into vacation rentals. And the second, and it sounds like you're criticizing this, and that's an empirical question, whether or not it does increase the value or the cost for long-term renters, but there's a suspicion that it does too, that it's much better and more profitable for you to save your rental unit, rent it through Airbnb to tourists rather than giving a long-term lease to local residents. And so that's the fight. And the thing about this issue, which I think you might not appreciate from the outside, is that it's an incredibly emotional issue. Legislators that I've talked to say that this Airbnb issue is the one thing where their constituents get most
knocked
in their
down,
face, start
out,
crying about, because it's about money. And people here, it's tough
it's
to live here,
money,
as we
but
know.
It's also about how you feel about your home.
That's right,
and
your community.
Your ability to act in your own home and use it to your own advantage. How you feel about your community, all of that, and if there's nothing closer to you than home, it's family, and all of that seems to be supported for some people by how they are able to rent out a home and be able to support the rest of it.
That's right. And you can imagine people saying, who are you to tell me I can't rent my home to tourists if I want to? What could possibly be the objections? It's my house. I can do what I want with it. So I think this is a fascinating fight.
It's a classic American argument about community and the individual. But the other thing, I keep wanting to go back to the big picture, man. The big picture here is the fact there isn't enough rental. There aren't enough rental units generally. Whether Mike is wrong or about the data or how incomplete the data is, the fact of the matter is we don't have enough rental units. The cost of affordable the difference between what the average rental unit costs on the market and what the average person can pay is enormous. And you do have some bills for rental assistance in the legislature this time, but that's what's driving the economics of it. It certainly doesn't get at all of this community issue, which is really very powerful.
That's right. And I mean, no matter what happens with the Airbnb issue, this is just another fight around the margins. This is not going to do much of anything, no matter what happens, to give people more access to affordable housing, which is why, frankly, I was so upset that Willis Sparrow's $2 billion bond measure went down. Not that I was surprised about that, but if you want to do something, it's not about slightly increasing the rental tax credit. It's not about whatever you do with Airbnb. You got to go big.
And unfortunately, we went home on that one.
That's right.
Not to get homes for a lot of people.
Watch Kakaako. Watch these other areas. And keep in mind what the legislator's goal is for affordable housing and how – or the state's goal is and how little we're moving in that direction.
We have another caller on the line also wanting to talk about houses, but this time tiny homes. This is about HB2. Stephen calling us from Kohala on the Big Island. Aloha, Stephen. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
A pleasure.
I'm calling in support of House Bill 2, which crossed over to the Senate this week, and also which has unanimous support from the County Council with a resolution passed yesterday here on the Big Island. HB2 would allow tiny homes to be used by farmers on ag lots and for farm workers on ag lots that are actively farming on the Big Island.
And on this one, have you seen a great deal of debate on this? Most of the people I've talked to have said, okay.
I mean, I know this is a big issue for some local organic farmers. I've heard from some farmers who, you know, have to, you know, they would love to be able to house their workers on the property. Technically, they're not allowed to do that legally. I don't really see this. I think this is a sensible proposal, but I think it goes back to people's fears about kind of creating squatter residences or tenements or on ag land. I mean, I
that kind of depends on what those tiny houses look like. I mean, some of them are tiny but beautiful, and they're functional, and they look nice, too.
That's right. I think it's been shown that you can have a pretty nice tiny house. Although I will say that, you know, there are we've tried something like this with the Ohana units, and people haven't really jumped to construct those Ohana units. I mean, that was supposed to create these tiny residences on people's or as part of people's existing urban residences, and not a lot of people have taken advantage of that. So this might help, you know, the small number of farmers who house workers on their land.
Right.
But
this has a different.
It's called plantation housing.
Yeah. Well, right. Yeah.
And that worked pretty. I mean, we're not talking about that. Dynamics of
the
power in a plantation.
Yeah.
Right.
The other side that you always worry about, and I don't see it being an issue here with ag land, is not small houses, it's big houses. People essentially violating the ag land policy by building a huge house and
right.
I don't know what, planting a dandelion or not planting anything at all. And you know, those kind of ag.
Right.
Egg mansion.
And so the
that
virtue of this,
like,
yeah,
yes.
is that it's restricted to 500 square
yeah,
feet.
So
that's a pretty small house.
Yes.
All right. We're going to continue on with some of our lists. If you'd like to join us with a subject that we haven't talked about yet, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Let's continue on this list and talk about something completely different from housing. Let's talk about mail voting, voting by mail. We've been talking about how this might happen, and now we see this bill going. We saw it come right up to the line this year. Any better shot?
I don't know if it has a better shot or not. This is pretty comprehensive bill. This would mean that we would be doing mail voting for our elections by 2020. And as I understand the bill, there would be a limited number of non-veil, you know, the old-fashioned kind of polling places available, but at a very limited state, mainly for more people with special needs. If you combine this with the past legislation where we're moving towards same-day registration, the theory is that this will really increase voter turnout. We've talked about increasing voter turnout before, and well, Colin can speak for himself. I'm skeptical whether he'll do as much as he say, but this is a fairly important move, and you didn't hear much about this.
No.
I don't know if that's because the legislature doesn't want to talk about it or people didn't come forward, whether a Common Cause or the League came forward on this. I don't know. It didn't get any publicity, that's for sure.
Yeah, very little publicity. I mean, mail-in voting is not necessarily a bad thing, but anyone who thinks it's going to do much to increase our voter turnout is fooling themselves. There's just no evidence that that's the case. You know, there's also some legitimate questions when you move to all mail-in voting about when people are voting, about even the security of ballots. I think this is sort of a solution in search of a problem. I don't understand why the mixed hybrid system we have now is
we buy things all the time
online.
We give all kinds of information online.
Well, moving to online voting is a different beast. I mean, that there are serious security questions about that.
But the point is that sometimes people think that, you know, if you do it by mail, it's going to be safer than if you do things online.
Oh, you're talking about online voting. Yes.
Well, what I'm saying is that, you know, the idea of safety and some of the concerns with this that we're voting, well, is something going to be more vulnerable if it's done by mail or if it's done online? And yet, ironically, you watch people put all kinds of stuff online. And so I think you're right. This is just a problem that it really doesn't
exist. Hey, considering WikiLeaks and the CIA, God knows what you're talking about in terms of security.
you know, the truth of the matter, yeah.
I don't know who's hearing this, and I don't know who's hearing what I'm thinking.
The truth of the matter with mail-in voting that most of the studies have shown is that people who already vote now just
anyway.
Mail
yes.
in their vote
yep.
instead of going to the so you know it's maybe more convenient
so you do it
but
at your coffee table.
people yeah. who don't vote aren't going to decide now I'm going to become a voter now that I can mail it in. It just doesn't happen.
All right, going to take a few more calls. Sean calling us from Ala Moana wants to talk about SB 501 forcing religious based clinics to provide abortion literature. That one wasn't on my list, but I'm glad it's on yours, Sean. Aloha, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. So, first of all, I am in support of women's access to safe abortion, but this bill is misguided because it is against First Amendment rights of free speech. You cannot, the government should not be forcing religious groups who are against abortion for moral reasons to provide information about abortions.
Either one of you want to be
well,
able to
first
take
of all,
one?
If it is a violation, it's probably, this is just a small point, it's probably not the free speech violation here. It's the impinging on religion violation. Mm-hmm. The best thing I can say about this is that I think it would be, there are two things. One, it would be likely to be challenged if it passes, probably by representatives of religious conservatives. But two, it is a much more open question that the courts have been struggling for a long time about this kind of thing. So I'm hedging here because I don't think there's a definitive answer here. It certainly raises the kind of typical religious objections that have been raised before, but there isn't a consistent pattern on how that would be resolved.
Anything more from you?
I think Neil has pretty much described the issue accurately. I mean, this is one of these many bills that make it through crossover that don't get very much attention. I suspect it won't succeed, but and if it does, of course, it will be in part tied up in the courts.
Yeah, I think it may not succeed because it's too controversial,
yeah.
Not because there are strong, not because the legislators feel
it's
strong.
It's one of these bills that, you know, like our caller, will generate a lot of opposition, but people in support of it, I mean, this doesn't provide them a lot.
It didn't
yeah.
have the kind of tensions, public tensions, that other kinds of issues, same-sex marriage or other kinds of things. It just never got that serious.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on and talk about a few other issues here. The gun legislation that is proposed that may go through, about seizing guns from people who might be in danger of doing harm to themselves or to others, the giving police the power to do that. A lot of people are looking at this and shooting up eyebrows thinking, wait a minute, you know, is this more power that you want to give to the police force, or you want to be a little more cautious about this?
Yeah, two groups have come out against this. Of course, the gun rights lobby, the National Rifle Association, is vehemently opposed to this. But also, I think people have questions about whether or not we want to trust HPD and, you know, other police departments to give them this power to take away people's guns who are considered a danger to themselves or others. I mean, this is kind of a broader gives the police a lot of discretion. A partner to this bill that failed was prohibiting people on the federal terrorist watch list from possessing a gun or ammunition. That went down. But the one that crossed over are these quote unquote potentially dangerous people and allowing police officers to seize their firearms. I suspect, again, that this is probably – I don't know. Do you think this is going to pass, Neil?
If there's any gun control legislation that comes up in this state that might have a little bit of trouble, I think it's this
yeah.
one because of the arbitrary nature to it. You know,
and also the time frame in which it's coming
also
up.
Also the time frame. I mean, it's no surprise that the NRA is against this because they are against any regulation of guns. But I think this – The process by which you'd be able to take away this gun is a little bit on the controversial side.
All right, let's move on. I want to talk about the aging, the issue of aging and the Capuna bills. I'm going to turn that over to you because I know that's something that you have a particular spotlight on.
Well, I think, again, let me start quickly with the long-term, short-term thing. A long-term, more basic solution or move toward a solution would be seeing long-term care as social insurance. That is, somehow we would pay money sort of like Social Security, where you would then everybody would have some kind of long-term care, which meant if you reached a certain point where you needed sheltered care, that there'd be a certain amount of money per day guaranteed to that. That didn't get anywhere. What you have is a series of things here. You have a bill that would help give respite to caregivers, essentially taking what you have now as the model as given. That is, people do what they can for themselves.
Right, this is a lot of what Ai-Jen Poo has been talking about.
Well, that's right. And you have, if you're fortunate enough, to have private long-term care insurance. So you have the Kapuna thing. It's not clear how much That's going to aid the Kupuna, the respite givers.
Because you're talking about $70 a day, and you're also talking about an appropriation that has to be made.
That's right. That's not there. And you have to understand how much care there is given, not just by the children of the elderly, but as someone told me recently, by the grandchildren of the elderly who sometimes take off school to have to take care of the kids. So you're still operating in that system. There is one other important bill in here, and it involves giving another staff member to the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. We're required to, every state's required to have one. It's federal law. This state has been the most understaffed state in the country. If you look at how many cases that it's supposed to be there, there is, after a long term, when the staff when Ombuds office lost one, there wasn't there. There now is a bill to put another staff member in there, which will still make the caseload very heavy. That's crossed over.
Our number is 941-3689. If you want to cross over via your phone and ask a question or let us know what you're following this time around, why, whether you're more engaged this time around, why or why not, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. While we're moving along, I want to also ask you about some of the things that are coming through education, all the way from pre-K all the way through the university. We would be remiss in not talking about some of those, I mean, about like the Hawaii Promise Bill, others that have crossed over.
That's right. This is there's some pretty innovative, two innovative bills that would provide a lot of relief for people who want to attend the University of Hawaii that are going under the name the Hawaii Promise. And this is following off, you know, some cities like the city of San Francisco that has made community college free. And that's what one of these bills would do, is essentially to provide access to community colleges for free. And then the companion bills would basically cover tuition at the University of Hawaii campuses for whatever your financial needs are that are unmet. So after you take the loans the federal government gives you, whatever financial aid is also available, if you qualify based on your family's income, you would essentially, the state would make up the rest of that money. You know, and this is I mean, the tuition at the University of Hawaii, people might not all know, is actually quite low compared to the mainland universities. But even still, for families who make less than $30,000 a year, sending their kids to college eats up a quarter of their income. We have low tuition, but we don't have a particularly generous financial aid policy. And this really would solve that problem for a lot of local kids. It would also solve a problem for the University of Hawaii, which, of course, you know, I have an interest in since that's my employer, where we see enrollment declining. And that's a big problem. The hope is that it would keep enrollment numbers up, which would help the university. It would encourage more kids to stay here rather than going to the mainland, and it would also provide them with a relatively free education. I think there's a lot of support for this both at the university and at the legislature.
A community college, here's a way to think about some of these, the community college part of it. You pretty much need a community college education to get a decent job in today's society. One of the big obstacles for community college is, first of all, the tuition, but also the fact that people drop out because they have to earn money. And once you drop out of community college, the likelihood of coming back is not very high. So that's part of it. You want to talk about the non-college stuff?
Right, the lower end.
The lower end. Well, first of all, start with the big one that HSTA, the teachers union, has been after, where the bill has crossed over that would allow for a constitutional amendment that would mandate that revenues gathered from a surcharge on expensive homes and on certain kinds of rental properties would be earmarked for K-12 education. And that's gotten a lot of play. I'm not so sure how that one's going to go, because that's the kind of thing that legislators are a little nervous about. I mean, on the one hand, it does, they can pass the buck, but that's clearly one. That's the big one this time. There's a bill for air conditioning abatement, since we were a little bit optimistic about 9,000 units optimistic about what we could do. It's the final thing is that there is some stuff in there for early education, as the state kind of zigzags forward to make early education, pre-K and maybe even earlier, available to more people. We're not even moving in the direction of universal early education and universal pre-K, but there is clearly a movement here to make it easier for people without money to get certain kinds of things and to allow charter schools to have the opportunity to do this.
All right, we're going to take another caller. Kate, calling us from Mililani, wants to talk about SB 739. That's the Behavioral Analyst Certification Bill, I believe. Anyway, Kate, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you for taking my call.
What can we do for you?
So I'd like to go ahead and put out my opinion on Senate Bill 739, strong opposition of it. It's a bill that psychologists are trying to implement, saying that basically changing an existing law, which is Act 199, that behavior analysts would be that they must be licensed, and they are the only professionals that should be designing and implementing therapeutic program for behavior analysis. And it also they're also trying to do away with any of the paraprofessional certifications. Those would be the people who would actually be implementing some of the therapeutic interventions. I strongly oppose it because it wouldn't affect many services that are paid for by insurance, but where I think it would make the strongest impact and really negative impact would be in the Department of Education. And this is helping our teachers and our paraprofessionals with anything from behavior problems to increasing academic skills and social skills for children with autism as well as other learning disabilities. If this law is passed, it would basically mean anyone, any psychologist could implement any of these things, and then anyone else, any paraprofessional, any teacher's aide, even the janitor could implement the therapeutic interventions. And I really think it would decrease the effectiveness and the quality of care that our children are getting. It'll also decrease the help and the ability for our teachers and our paraprofessionals in the Department of Education to liaison and reference with someone who has this type of training.
All right. Let me see if either Neil or Colin want to comment on this one.
Well, no? I don't want to speak to the merits of her argument. I want to do say that that's an important argument. It's so important that you've already heard it in a different capacity. It's this, and you're going to hear it in another capacity. It's the same kind of argument that you make about licensing or not licensing midwives,
right?
And it's the same kind of argument that you make when you deal with whether psychologists should have the capacity to prescribe certain kind of drugs. And when I say that, what I'm saying is how important that argument is and how difficult it is to resolve and why you need kind of cold, hard-headed regulation people to really take a look at the economics of all of this, because behind a lot of these things is an issue of cost, and that regulation does affect cost.
All right. Anything else you want to add to that, Colin? Okay, well, time is running short. We only have about 7 minutes more to the hour, and I want to make sure that we get through some more of the issues that are on our list. You know, a bill that has people really chafing is this idea that there are going to be cams for speeding and red lights back again. Now, we kind of have been around this. We've been around this bend once before, or a couple times before.
That's right. There's a slate of these traffic bills, and I'm sure people are listening to this in their car, so it's maybe immediately relevant. Yeah. So red light cameras might come back in. There's also bills to increase pretty dramatically the fines for DUIs, the fines for excessive speeding in construction zones and school areas. I don't know exactly why now. I mean, why this is back on now, but they are, and how the legislature handles these. I don't really know. I mean, I know that red light cameras are hugely unpopular, but it did cross over. I suspect that some of increasing fines for violators, that tends to be fairly politically popular. That may go through. But it's interesting that all of this all cropped up now without a lot of discussion.
Yeah.
I can't explain it.
Neil?
I don't have anything to
say. All right.
The CIA could be involved.
Okay, thank you very much.
One thing we should talk about before we forget, though, which is a very important bill that hasn't got as much press as I would have expected, is the paid sick leave bill. This did cross over. It's gotten very little attention. I don't know why that is. It's HB 4. And this would, for the first time, establish a requirement that everyone would have some
right.
form
and we've talked
paid
about
sick
that.
Leave.
I can't think about how many years we've talked about that, and then you've been working on it. Certainly, Kathy Betts in the Office on the Status of Women has been working on that. All the arguments are the same. It goes back to that question, why now?
I don't know. I mean, it has been discussed a lot. I mean, there's more and more evidence that shows that actually this is a huge benefit to the workplace. It actually saves money because people don't show up sick. You know, they end up being more productive. They don't pass their illnesses on to their fellow employees. But again, this is this fight that often exists here in Hawaii, which is that small businesses already feel so burdened by so many requirements that they make a pretty powerful argument to many legislators who say, look, we're already, you know, the 49th or 50th or whatever the statistic is, worst state for business. Don't make me do something else.
Okay, so this is sort of under that heading of everyday life legislation that may come through. We have some others. One that considers what happens if you're in a condo situation and you're at odds with your association.
Ah, yes, condos. Since the first condo bills were passed in America, which basically protected people against developers, almost every kind of condo law in the past 50 years have been to protect condo owners from other condo owners and to really resolve conflicts. What you have at this time, and anybody who lives in a condo can recognize this, is a series of bills that try to protect people who have been at odds with condo boards, to protect them from harassment, to make their opportunities to see certain things that condo boards are doing, and to give condo and to make certain kind of things clear when you can go into executive session and when you can't. This is not earth shattering, but it's the kinds of things that come up
that
all the time
in daily life.
Oh,
right,
yes,
right.
Especially elderly people, actually.
All right, one more before we're going to go. Low income tax credit for renters. We didn't get to that one yet.
You know, that's another one that's been hanging around for a while. We've talked about this. Our income tax credit for renters is not particularly generous. This would increase it. It'll help some folks a little bit. It's one of these incremental changes. It's not going to change anyone's financial situation in a major way, but it's certainly a move in the right direction.
Well, we got to say goodbye in a little less than 2 minutes, but I want to ask both of you, as you're looking out now at the second half, which is usually the time when things begin to ramp up and we really see some of those real fights, particularly this year over money that will be happening. Any particular way in which you're regarding this session and you would point people to maybe do likewise?
Well, I think there's the sense of guarded pessimism that's involved with the money issue. It's been there almost from the beginning when the Council of Revenues lowered its expectations. And remember, our budgets have to be balanced. And it certainly has been there today when the budget people announced that Jill Takuda announced that she was going to cut $500 million from the government's budget. So I think there's going to be a lot of those things. And if you put that together with collective bargaining, that's going to be a stressor.
That's right.
And Colin?
Money and collective bargaining combined with some of these moral issues like medical aid and dying, which we didn't get to, I think, is the theme of the session.
All right. Well, we're going to be watching. You guys will be back and we'll take a look at what's happening as the session comes to its close in, about a month and a half or so. We hope you'll come back with us tomorrow morning for the conversation. I'll be here with Chris Vandercook, and we will see you then. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Aloha.